Hi, everyone. This is from NQF again. Just letting you know that we'll be starting in a couple minutes. Thank you for your patience in the meantime. Hi, everyone. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the second subgroup number one call. Oddly enough, while we were in the first one, it is our last call of the subgroups. So this is going to complete everything, and then we can have a finalized list of what's going to be moving forward. So as a reminder to everyone, to the panel members, a discussion guide was sent out in that email. Also, a SurveyMonkey link was sent out. Please make sure to keep that open and put your votes in as we go through the different measures to be discussed. Staff will prompt you when it's appropriate to go ahead and vote in. We are discussing five renal measures that we were not able to get to at the last subgroup call, and Andrew will be leading that discussion. We might discuss one more measure if we have time for it, but we'll see how we're going at that point. With that, today's call is limited. We have 2 hours. Unfortunately, this is our last follow-up call, so we really need to get through all five measures today and make sure we're able to come to consensus on anything that we have not been able to so far. And then also as a reminder, this is a public call. The developer will be on the line to answer questions, but there will be no opportunity for public comment. Also for record keeping purposes, please state your name each time that you are going to make a comment so it's easier for us to know who's speaking and also to keep track of it later. With that, I'll give it to Andrew to do roll call and to start the discussion.
Thanks, Poonam. All right, so I'll just run through our subgroup reviewers here to see who's on the call. Bijan Bora.
Present.
Okay.
I'm there.
Great, thanks. Paul Kurlansky. John Bott.
Yep, here.
Hi. Jeff Geppert.
I'm here.
Great, thanks. And Sherry Kaplan. All right. Well, we can go ahead and get started and get into our discussion here. So just as a reminder, we were reviewing on the last call a set of measures from our renal project. There were a number of concerns about the method of testing for reliability and the results. Particularly, I think we had some questions about the method for testing reliability around the bootstrapping approach, and we were hoping to get a bit of clarification from the developer on this call. There was also at least one measure where face validity only had been provided for a maintenance measure, and we wanted to see if the developer could give us a rationale for only having face validity and try to make a determination on whether that was an acceptable justification or not. So we can sort of just get started, I think, maybe with, well, I don't know if we should go measure by measure, or maybe we should allow the developer to make some remarks up front and just give sort of a general overview of their grasping approach, if they're ready to do
hello?
That. Yes, hello?
Yeah, hi, this is Paul Kalansky. I'm sorry I'm late.
Okay, great, no problem. We're just going to have our developers of the set of renal measures give an overview of their testing methodology, particularly with respect to the bootstrapping approach. Do we have the developers online?
Yeah. Hi, Andrew. This is Joe Masana from U of M Keck.
Hi.
I'm here with our group, notably with Rajiv Saran, who's the other clinician on our group that worked on development of the KT over V measures and PCR measures, and Professor Doug Schaubel from our biostatistics department, who spoke briefly on the last call and I think has more information about bootstrap and the other reliability, the other IUR concern that had been raised but not completely resolved. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Schaubel, Doug, now to speak.
Yeah, so going back to the last call, one of the concerns was, well, one of the questions was how many bootstrap resamples we did. So there were 1,000 bootstrap resamples. And the next question related to how exactly the bootstrapping was done. So it was done within facility. So for each facility, we actually resampled the individuals. And so we took an individual's experience over, say, the calendar year and resampled that so that we're maintaining the correlation structure in the original data. We'd also made some comments about normality and the issues surrounding that came up at the last call, and I think that's really a red herring. The idea is that if we're doing if we're actually doing analysis of variance and if we're fitting a mixed model and trying to interpret the parameters of that model, that does require normality. And on the other hand, the decomposition into between and within does not. It basically, we're requiring that the mean exists, which is a very safe assumption in the context of these data, and that the variance exists, which is also a safe assumption. So we can still meaningfully calculate between and, or rather within and total, and take the difference to get between. And the ratio that's taken to get the IUR is still meaningful, whether or not we have normality. So none of that depends on normality. Again, if we were doing IUR differently, if we were relying on a mixed model to come up with those calculations, that does require normality. But we were taking pretty dramatic steps to avoid that. That's where the bootstrapping came in. So we did evaluate the skewness and the kurtosis for various measures, and I could go through those. So I think that's really that's kind of a moot point at this stage. And I think our language. Is a bit regrettable. I think that to say that the results have to be interpreted with caution because of potential non-normality, I think that's overstated. That's all for now.
Okay, thank you. Any thoughts or discussion on that from our reviewers?
Hi, this is Bijan from Mayo Clinic. So I think one of the I think this is Sherry that who brought up. I was under the impression that some of these say skewness and other measure, other statistics would be shared with us before this meeting. So I guess again, I mean, it's not that we are trying to kind of hold this whole thing, but it would have been really helpful if we would have seen those numbers play in front of us, but not knowing, I guess, you know, how what was the sort of, you know, extent of skewness or the, you know, cartesian in the distribution of the data that you have. I mean, that would have been really helpful for us to see.
This is Andrew, just to respond from NQS side. Our determination. Just for the sake of consistency and, I guess, fairness with respect to other developers,
okay. We
didn't really want to sort of allow for additional written materials. We felt that might be inconsistent, again, with the sort of deadlines and requirements we imposed on the rest of our developers. So we asked the developers in this instance to just give us an oral sort of explanation and report on the method. So
Andrew, Dr. Schauble is prepared to read them if it's required by the methods group. We don't want to withhold any information, but for the sake of time, I think his initial response suggests that the degree that with which these data are different from normal is not critically important here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, so in terms of skewness for adult, KT over V, hemo, so skewness is negative 7.3. It's negative 3.2 for PD, adult PD, KT over V. For pediatric hemo, KT over V, it's negative 1, and it's also negative 1 for pediatric PD, KT over V. Kurtosis for adult hemo, KT over V, was about 91. For adult PD, KT over V, was about 15. And for pediatric hemo, KT over V, was 0.07. And for pediatric PD, KT over V, was 0.14.
All right, thank you for that. So maybe we can just, again, have a bit of discussion over the general approach. Are any thoughts from our panel members on the issue of the sort of normality or lack of normality in the distribution, and are you sort of comfortable now that the reliability results are reflect, you know, the true reliability of the measure, or are an appropriate approach to testing reliability?
This is Paul Kalansky. I had a completely different concern about reliability. I wasn't particularly bothered by this particular issue, so I don't know if it's appropriate to comment.
Well, you can go ahead and talk about what your concerns were.
There were a number of measures, but I'm just looking back at my review of 249. Is that mm-hmm. that?
We can just kind of use that one to start with.
And I thought that the score level testing was appropriate, but there didn't seem to be testing of data element reliability. And one of the references actually said, no center apart from, I'm just quoting, no center apart from one unit managed to complete the collection of blood specimens as recommended by the guidelines. With one exception, blood collection for hemodialysis adequacy was not performed using proper technique in any center. So this would suggest the data element used for the measure may not be reliable. And I was just concerned about the data element reliability testing would therefore need to be documented, not so much the measure itself.
Mm-hmm. Did the developer have any thoughts or response on that?
Yes, Andrew, we do.
Okay.
Is it time now?
Yes, that would be fine.
All right. So I'd like to make sure, before I try to respond to the reviewer's concern, that the meeting minutes needs to include a note that states that, as a measure developer, I'm really confused about how one study from an old evidence form submitted in 2015 that is not really being interpreted in the context or with regard to the study's limitations is potentially threatening re-endorsement of a familiar, multiply endorsed measure. I'm really confused about that process because
it's the first reference.
Well, let me.
You reference it.
I did not reference it. It was referenced in the 2015 evidence form submission, which we have not yet submitted, and which is not on our current list.
I don't know where I got it from. Then.
I don't either, which is part of the problem from my perspective. Now, I'll discuss the article if you give me just a minute here. Prior NQF renal standing committees made up of individuals with extensive dialysis expertise have not expressed concern about this issue, the dependency of accurate KT over V on appropriate blood draw technique has been known for over 20 years, and the dialysis community's comfort level with it has been demonstrated by this measure's repeated endorsement by NQF over the last decade. The Ulisoy article that you refer to, included in the 2015 submission, describes a clinical study from nearly a decade ago in 8 Turkish dialysis centers. It is not generalizable to U.S. dialysis centers and has significant methodological limitations. It's not well-blinded. It's not a crossover study, so the study effect bias is very likely. The dependence of KT over V on appropriate blood drawing at the end of treatment has been a known issue in the dialysis community for over 2 decades. Appropriate techniques regarding blood drawing technique were included as part of the 2000 KDOQI hemodialysis adequacy guidelines, reinforced in the 2008 update to the ESRD conditions for coverage by Medicare with a specific VTAG citation for failure to use proper technique, and it's in the Medicare claims processing manual revisions from 2010 when KT over V was added as a required data element. This is old news. That study, I don't know why that study was included in the evidence form in 2015, but probably to demonstrate that appropriate technique is needed. But regulatory standard practice in the dialysis community is known about this, in the U.S. dialysis community is known about this for probably 25 years. There is literature, at least one single center study, that demonstrates that the mismatch between prescribed from urea kinetic modeling and delivered, which would be the result from inappropriate blood drawing at the end of the dialysis, that's the main reason. About 3% of samples show that in a 2003 study from the Case Western group that was published looking at about 800 monthly dialysis specimens. There is no widespread evidence that this is operative in the U.S. dialysis community. And the Renal Standing Committee's endorsement of this measure in, for at least 2 prior go-arounds is strong corroborative evidence that they're not worried about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Help us that evidence were included in the submission.
So at this point, we don't require evidence to be included in the review. I think there might have, you know, we do try to include as much information as possible for your review. But then also, I think if you there is a study out there that contradicts whatever is found, and you are to find it, you should be using that to your best of your knowledge. But thank you for your response, Joel. Andrew, I'll give it back to you to continue on.
Yeah, appreciate that. And yeah, I should note that the developers will have an opportunity to update their evidence form. That's something that we're, you know, they have a bit of time to do before the official submission date. We're sort of still supposed to be reviewing just the specifications and testing information at this stage. Any thoughts or comments from our reviewers on that explanation or sort of response to the concerns about data element? I don't know if they just want to check it. Has Sherry joined the line yet? Doesn't sound like it. Okay.
This is Jeff. I have a couple other questions. Just
yeah, sure. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah. So I'm not challenging the developer in any way. I'm just obviously you don't need to get defensive, but I'm just trying to understand, just for my own knowledge. This is the first time I've actually seen the IRU used as a metric of reliability. So can you just briefly explain sort of the rationale for choosing that particular metric, you know, versus the things that are more commonly used, like the Adams approach? Or
So, this is Joe Masana. I'm sitting around the table with two senior biostatisticians here at University of Michigan, and we've been submitting measures to the National Quality Forum for over a decade, since I think 2007. We were asked to start using IUR for reliability, I believe it was 2010 or 2011, by the National Quality Forum. And so I'm confused by the question.
Like I said, you don't need to get defensive. You're very defensive today, and I understand. You know, this is sort of this overview process, and I'm just asking. So you're explaining something to me.
You were told
by NQF staff that was a good metric to use.
Yes.
So thank you for that explanation.
If you sense defensiveness, it's because we believe very strongly that these measures move forward, and we were concerned about the possibility that they would not.
Okay, yeah. No, I mean, it's good that you're passionate about your measures, and we're just trying to, use due diligence in terms of our review and make sure that we understand. And I think, you've done a good job of sort of explaining your thought process. And so I think your point about sort of being, so anyway, we'll have to look into that, sort of talk to NQF about that. The other sort of, again, sort of informational question I have is, there was an article last year, and maybe you're actually on the calls, is one of you Kalbflisch, John Kalbflisch?
Dr. Kalbflisch is in the room, yes.
Okay. So you wrote an article last year in Health Services Research about the use of IRU as a measure of reliability, where you advocated against it. My interpretation was. So I just, could you just kind of explain sort of that article and kind of the discussion today?
Yeah. So I guess it was reacting a bit to the very strong recommendations that we've got from NQF in the past, that reliability should be measured entirely by IUR. And I think sometimes that's appropriate and sometimes it's not. But there's really been no distinguishing like that. So it's been recommendations of IUR have been that we should be reporting IUR on every measure, and they even put in lower bounds for it, which I think are not particularly sensible. So it's something that we've had some discussion with NQF in the past on occasion. That article was written, I guess, partly to discuss a bit what the rationale for IUR as a measure of reliability is, conditions under which it would make sense to stay with that, and the conditions under which you should really relax that interpretation. So okay. In a sense, IUR really, as it's proposed in the Adams manuscript that I guess NQF now refers to, is really an appropriate measure of reliability if all the inter-quality or inter-hospitals differences are due to quality of care. So as long as there's no unmeasured confounders that are affecting the facility levels, then it's an appropriate measure, and I think that's rarely the case. So it still tells you something about signal to noise, but I think it's a specific measure of reliability. It's not generally the best thing to do.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. My just our last question is about sort of the risk adjustment. So you don't risk adjust. It's an intermediate clinical outcome measure. That's common. I mean, most intermediate clinical outcome measures are not risk adjusted. But can you just sort of speak to that? Do you have concerns about that, or are you comfortable with that? Is the community comfortable with that?
Trying not to be defensive. This is Joe Masana again.
Yeah.
The community has been comfortable with not risk adjusting these measures, as evidenced by prior recommendation for endorsement by the Renal Standing Committee. These measures are really fundamental, basic outcomes that are minimum standards, kind of really more focused on exceeding that dialysis facilities deliver in excess of minimum for both for the small solute clearance and for the avoiding hypercalcemia measure. And they're they have good success at achieving these results across the board. But they're really exceeding, these measures were designed to be consistent with regulations and minimum requirements recommended by the consensus endorsement documents. And so we don't think they need to be risk adjusted because most dialysis patients should be able to achieve these values. And so risk adjustment has not been deemed necessary, and I think the dialysis community generally agrees with that.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your answers to the questions. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. So was there anything else that anybody wanted to discuss about number 249? I think we've gotten some responses about the method and approach for assessing reliability. We talked a little bit about the risk adjustment and just seeing if there's anything else we needed to talk about. I think those were the major issues that we had identified in our preliminary reviews. Any other discussion of 249, or shall we go ahead and take a revote?
Yeah, this is John Bott. A comment that relates to a number of these intermediate outcome measures, and as far as what Jeff Geppert just asked about, and as far as risk adjustment goes, it seems the response oftentimes, and with this measure and a number of other ones, is inadequate. The measure steward / developer stated something to the effect of risk adjustment is not necessary, but we really don't have any evidence presented to us that it wasn't necessary. And so they don't go on to say, you know, we checked, here's what we found, thus it's, you know, we don't think it needs to be risk adjusted. It's like we just have a lack of adequately defending the lack of risk adjustment, and I thought for outcome measures and intermediate outcome measures, correct me if I'm wrong, you need to state your case more empirically why you're not risk adjusting. And I just thought a concerted effort should have been made to vet this to see if it would have benefited by it, and I didn't see that. So I thought there needed to be a better case made to defend the lack of risk adjustment.
So we have sort of established that expectation for outcome measures. I don't know that we've sort of historically communicated that kind of expectation to developers for intermediate outcome measures. It is something that we're talking about now, sort of the approach to you know, reviewing risk adjustment with intermediate outcomes. I should also note, and Karen, correct me if I'm wrong about this, we're trying to, our sort of guidance to the methods panel has been that we shouldn't stop measures at this point due to a lack of risk adjustment or, you know, any particular concerns about risk adjustment approach, because that's something that we're sort of seeing as more in our standing committee's domain with their clinical expertise in the topic. So we can certainly communicate concerns about a lack of risk adjustment to the standing committee along with the methods panel's other findings and ratings. But it's not something that in itself should hold up the measure at this stage of review. Is that correct, Karen?
This is Karen. Not quite, Andrew, but you're close.
Okay.
going back to, well, first of all, let me just, what we asked the methods panel not to do is not to fail a measure or simply because they disagree with the inclusion or lack of inclusion of certain factors in the risk adjustment model. And that usually that has come up primarily in sociodemographic types of factors. So, but it's still certainly within your purview to consider whether or not risk adjustment, you know, you feel that risk adjustment overall should have been done, or, you know, that the, you know, the risk model calibration, discrimination, that sort of thing is reasonable. So that is within your purview, but we ask you not to quibble and fail just on a, you know, a specific factor or two or something like that. Going back to John's question, we would love to see empirical analysis demonstrating that risk adjustment is not needed. However, for some measures, and usually it's outcome measures, but I think I would probably treat intermediate outcome measures, you know, in the same way. We could, if it's reasonable to you guys, we have allowed things to go through with a conceptual rationale. You know, and I'll give you an example. You know, sometimes people will say, well, in hospital mortality, you know, we don't need to adjust for certain things, or maybe we don't need to adjust. And that might not be a good example, and I apologize if that's a bad example. But so, John, you could certainly, we will convey that you would like to see analysis, you know, really kind of demonstrating no need for risk adjustment. But at minimum, we would need to see some kind of a conceptual narrative about why they didn't do it or why they don't feel that it's needed. I hope that's clear. John, is that clear? And Andrew, did I? Would like to
I understand. This is John. I understand what you're saying. The instruction on our TA form, whatever you call it, for question 16 in the comment area, it says question 16, which is risk adjustment, it says applies to all outcome costs, et cetera, measures. So what I thought you meant by outcomes includes, you know, PROPMs and intermediate outcomes, unless you specify otherwise. So you might want to think about how you articulate outcomes when you say outcome.
Yeah, no, it definitely includes intermediate outcomes, PROPMs, just regular health outcomes. So we definitely want you guys to be thinking about risk adjustment and need for. But all I'm saying is if a developer has said, you know, they provided some kind of a narrative to describe conceptually, you might be willing to, you know, we're okay with leaving it at that and not having actual empirical results. But that's something that we could talk about in the future. You know, should we always require empirical and, you know, not just the conceptual side?
This is Joe Masana at Keck. If we would offer a comment from Dr. Kalbfleisch related to this matter, if you believe it's appropriate at this point.
This is along the lines of more of a conceptual narrative. Is that what you're thinking?
I never know exactly what Jack is going to say, but I guess so. He's been listening into this.
I guess the point I was just wanting to make, and I think it's one that Joe made too, but it's just that what this is a process measure, and it's sort of a level of care that one expects of every individual, and that measure is really checking on that, and you wouldn't really want to adjust that for age. I mean, because it's not like that measure should be different for younger people or older people. They all should get that level of care, and a measure like that, really, risk adjustment doesn't make that much sense. I think where it makes sense is where your outcome is something like mortality or hospitalization or readmission, where there are aspects of that that aren't under the control of the facility, and consequently you don't want to penalize them because they've got old patients that are dying quickly or other things. You want to take that into account. That's not the case with a process measure where you really want to deliver a standard of care to everybody, and I think that's the difference.
Note that you cut the box as this is an intermediate outcome measure, and now you're calling it a process measure. So you need to think a little bit about how you're defining your measures.
Yeah, this is Jeff. My take on that, and I think I sort of just mentioned this last time, is that when, so it's labeled as an intermediate outcome measure, and I guess because it's a clinical health status, it's measured by a laboratory value. You know, but it's a health status that is sort of completely determined by a process of care. So to John's point, conceptually it is like a process measure. So it's kind of this weird sort of hybrid, you know, that I think is generating a little bit of confusion, but I think the explanation, conceptual rationale sort of makes sense.
I mean, I guess the conceptual rationale is that there's no a priori reason to believe that any risk factors would impair your ability to deliver the service differentially.
And that's a little different issue. You know, that's, again, it's sort of like does the sort of the quality construct vary by patient characteristics? It's harder to do this for some people than it is for others. That might be a sort of a case mix adjustment issue. Risk adjustment really has more to go to, like, you know, is the likelihood that you're going to actually achieve the clinical health status, you know, vary based on patient characteristic, regardless, independent of anything the provider might do. And I think what you're saying is that that's not true.
Right. That's my understanding.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So that makes sense. Yep. It's a mechanistic kind of relationship.
All right, so any additional discussion here? Or again, are we ready to take a vote? Without objection, I think
yeah.
we'll go
yeah.
with...
A second.
Sorry. Okay, we'll ask you to go ahead and fill out your SurveyMonkey. We are only voting on reliability for this measure. This did pass on validity.
And just repeat again what the measure number is that we're voting
Sorry,
on.
Yes. Thank you. 0249 is the measure you're voting on right now. So just the vote on reliability.
Could you send the SurveyMonkey again?
Yes. We will
bury it in my desk.
In the meantime, we can probably move on to the next, which I believe has very similar issues here. Let's see, I'm just pulling it up. Number 318. Delivered.
And just to be clear, so we're not revoting on validity because we voted on that last time.
Yes,
so we're
correct. Just reliability.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
And I think we've got the same basic issues for this measure as we did the last one. So does anybody want to continue the discussion, or are we comfortable?
Which measure are you looking at now?
Number 0318, delivered dose of peritoneal dialysis above minimum.
And our concern is with reliability?
Yes, there was. We got a consensus not reached rating on reliability. Same kinds of concerns here that the reviewers wanted additional details on the bootstrapping method. Some concern about the method of assessing reliability with the IUR approach. The same questions about data element reliability. Let's see. And then for this one, there were some questions about the specifications. Some reviewers were unclear about certain aspects of the numerator. The numerator details include a note that missing, expired, and not performed are not counted as achieving the minimum weekly KTV threshold. And reviewers were not quite clear on whether these instances were counted as a zero in the numerator or treated as exclusions or exceptions, so to speak. And maybe that's something we can get clarity from the developer on. My impression was that it is does appear to be treated as a zero in the numerator. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, as long as there is not a KT over V value within in the prior 3 months. So that is correct, and that specification is consistent with the consensus endorsement statements about peritoneal dialysis KT over V. Unlike hemodialysis, it's required every 4 months, not every month, according to the consensus statements.
Thank you.
This is Jeff. Can I ask a Prisma process question?
Sure.
So Sherry wasn't able to join us today.
Yeah.
Is she going to have a chance to weigh in? Could she listen to a transcript or something?
Yeah, we'll send her the recording and ask her to listen to it before she she may not have the opportunity to vote on these since she missed the call.
We've hit quorum on this call, meaning we have enough participants to go ahead and vote. So we will share the transcript and the recording with her as well as the public. But she wouldn't be re-voting on it. Only the people on the call would, just to make sure that it's consistent.
Does her pass vote apply to her?
This is John Bott. Are we voting now on 318, or are we about to begin discussion of 318?
Well, we're seeing if there is any discussion. Do you have any comments or questions before we go to a vote? Again, we got some response at the beginning of the call on the with regard to the bootstrapping approach and the inter-unit reliability testing method. I don't know if there were any additional questions about that. We did hear Karen reminds me that it may have been Sherry who was asking this. I think she had been asking about how many patients or people were included in the bootstrapping approach. I think maybe just one more reiteration from our developer might help. Again, how many, resamples were taken, how many patients were included, that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, this is Doug Schauble again from KEC. There were 1,000 bootstrap samples taken. We bootstrapped at the individual patient level, so all observations within a year, and the bootstrap was done within facility.
Can you just clarify, Michael from NQF here, when you bootstrapped, how much of the sample did you take? Does that make sense? So you did it 1,000 times. We get that, right? But how many did you take? Did you take half of it? Did you take...
Size of the data set, there's not a reason for doing less than the entire data set, or less than the size of the entire data set, unless you had maybe 2 million patients and it was computationally overwhelming to do so. Then as I discussed last call, you could take a fraction and then scale the results down.
So
we didn't
sample the whole thing every time? Is that what you're saying? I'm a little mystified by that, but is that, that's the process?
Maybe that would have been computationally challenging 15 years ago, but it wasn't these days.
I guess it just doesn't sound like bootstrapping, does it?
Right. To me, neither.
It's not a sample?
It's got to be a sample.
That's what bootstrapping is.
Maybe you have a different idea what the bootstrap is than me, and then the field of statistics.
Maybe I'm wrong. I thought bootstrapping is you take a random sample multiple times. Then you see certain things emerge.
Let me address this differently. So suppose this is the way it was done previously, many years ago. So if you took your original study population and magnified it, so in other words, created a superpopulation, then if it's from your original, it would have the same properties as your original data set, and then you could take samples from that superpopulation. And unless you have a good reason for doing something different, those samples should be still the same size as the original facility sizes across the country. So if that's what you're thinking of, what we did is equivalent to that. Just technically, it's different. In terms of the code that went into the process, it's different. But conceptually, it's the same thing. If I'm understanding what you're trying to say, you think we should have done.
Hi, this is Bijan. I think I think you did what I understand as bootstrapping. So just give you a concrete example. Say facility A has, say, 100 patients, for example. So in each of your 1,000 bootstrap applications, you essentially drew which replacement all the 100, from that 100 patients sample, you essentially make a draw of 100 patients which replacement, correct? I mean, that's what typically you do.
That is what we did. That's what we did.
That's what
we described.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Again, Michael from NQF here. I'm not a statistician, right? I've had some training in it, but is the committee comfortable with how the bootstrapping has been described? And if not, please do seek clarification now if you can.
This is Bijan. I think I understood. I am good.
Yep. Okay. Yes, good. I'm good.
I'm sorry with that, but okay.
All right. And that being said, unless there are any other issues that you'd like to discuss.
I had a very minor point
about
the specification, not about the reliability.
Sure.
And that is, do we know that, or does CMS know specifically that the measurement has been taken? In other words, how do we know that it's not the measurement from 3 months ago that's just being re-reported, and then the same one is re-reported? Is there a way to know that? Is there a claim filed when the measurement is taken, or is there some way to know that a new and current, measure, or at least within the last 4 month measure, has been taken?
Yeah. So this is Joe Masana. So both Crown Web data sources and claims data sources for this have a date the test was performed every time it's performed. And we, in our database, we maintain the date along with the KT over V determination that's reported by the facility, either into Crown Web or claims. That's how we use the current month or prior 3 months algorithm to determine missingness or presence. So
perfect.
All of those are stored, yes.
Perfect. Yeah. No, it wasn't clear to me. So thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. So are we ready to vote on number 0318? If no objections, we'll ask you to go ahead and do that. Again, we're voting only on reliability for this one. Okay. So next, we'll go on to measure.
Andrew.
Yes.
A quick question. Have you changed or sort of modified the SurveyMonkey form? Because unlike earlier time, now we get back to the, new survey form right here. Earlier, once we fill it up, then it just goes off, and then we have to link, click the link again. So now, which is a good thing. So is that something you did, am I getting it wrong?
To be honest, the person that usually handles SurveyMonkey is out today, and I'm just going to give her credit for fixing it. We're not
okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
As long as we're not, rewriting our old responses over and over again.
No.
Yep. Okay.
All right. So, yeah, please enter your vote for reliability on number 0318. And we will move along to measure number 1423, 1423. This is minimum STKTV for pediatric hemodialysis patients. Some of the same similar kinds of concerns here we've already talked about on the bootstrapping method, the IUR, the missing values. I think so I don't know that we need to talk about reliability again, unless does anybody want to say anything more about reliability on this issue or on this measure?
I think it's been answered by the response to the first question I asked. But when I saw this, this one is the pediatric one?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I guess because there are fewer centers and whatnot, I was more concerned about, with a limited number of available centers, if there was inter-center reliability or that had been tested, if there was evidence regarding that in the past. It may have been asked and answered elsewhere. I just didn't see it in the information that I had. In other words, is there any variability in the way this is measured from center to center?
This is Joe Masson. I would offer the same response as to your question for the adult. They use a standard approach, pre-dialysis, post-dialysis BUN, with appropriate blood sampling technique. And the calculations used are the same. The target recommendation is slightly higher based on the pediatric nephrology community's recommendations when the endorsements were put together.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. I think you answered this question. This was a question I had when I read the thing, but you answered it when you answered my first question, I think. So I'm good.
Yeah, I think the only difference here is in the adults there were – several, there are like 1,400 facilities, something
right,
like that.
Right, but that's what raised the question in my mind, is of whether or not there's variability in the kids.
Now there's 14.
In the adults.
Yeah. So do you have any concerns about the fact that there are only 14 facilities?
I mean, I think if it's that well standardized, I don't think it should matter.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Could this evolve to this comment on this is a topic that we've had a lot of internal discussion about is the idea of sort of minimum thresholds, and you're pretty consistent that you require at least 11 cases in your testing. Is that also the way it's reported? So you don't report any.
That is correct. And the reasons I think are historical, but a significant part of that threshold of not reporting less than 11 is because of potentially identifiable individual cells. You have a dialysis facility with a location, and reporting 8 or 10 is seen as potentially sharing identifiable information. And so we did the testing using the same approach that we do for public reporting.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Unless there are any objections, we'll move on to a discussion of validity. Then any more comments or questions on reliability for this measure? If not, we can go ahead to validity. We did have, so this measure, which is a maintenance measure, was submitted with face validity only. And so we wanted to hear from the developer what their justification for only giving face validity for this measure. So we can maybe hear from them now on that subject.
So this is Dr. Rajiv Saran, professor of internal medicine, who led the treatment group to respond.
A long time ago, but
yeah.
So recalling from 2010, I mean, we can go back to the transcripts, but the main issue that was discussed around the table at the time was that there's no actual data in the pediatric literature to support development of KTOV. KTOV was developed as a metric in adult population. Pediatric populations were not specifically studied. However, yeah.
The specific question now is reimbursement. Yes. For reimbursement, face validity, I believe, is not accepted without empiric testing. And so results of empiric testing are what they're asking for.
They go by the same thresholds and guidelines that are used for the adult population. The argument that was made for face validity is the fact that in the population, achieving these targets is even thought to be of greater importance because of kids' growth concerns. The concern was nutrition and growth for kids,
right.
And they said unless we endorse minimal thresholds, we may be doing the community a disservice, not having any standard at all.
And I thank you. What I would add is that for this submission, the very small number of facilities would not, based on preliminary calculations, would not have shown any associations. And I think the limit here is sample size.
Okay. So that is the rationale presented for face validity. Any discussion of that by our methods panel reviewers?
I guess, I sort of accept the face validity, but I was a little, I guess, disappointed because it's not a new metric, as you point out. And so in the last 10 years, I would have hoped, even if it's only 14 sites, I would have hoped that there would be a collection of an effort to collect empiric data to validate the measure that you, I understand the rationale that you adopted, but on the other hand, it was sort of a minimal rationale. You actually have reason to believe that perhaps for kids, maybe it should even be higher than the adult standard. And so with that concern, it would seem maybe ideal, but certainly better if there were empiric data to validate the threshold that you've chosen.
I appreciate that. The empiric results, identification of statistically significant associations with primary outcomes are negative, essentially, because of very small sample size.
If I may add, Srajeev, the duration of follow-up in the pediatric community is often shorter because they don't stay on dialysis for long enough to observe outcomes like mortality, especially
because of early
transplantation is usually the norm, so that there's not enough.
Thank you. That's a follow-up time.
Okay, any other thoughts or comments or questions for our developers or other points of discussion you'd like to raise for our reviewers?
So just as a thought experiment, so I know that there aren't that many facilities and there aren't that many kids. And with kids, it's always hard to do outcomes because they don't, like you said, I mean, mortality is not sort of relevant. You mentioned transplant as sort of a progression. If they don't transplant, then what happens to them? They just stay on dialysis?
Is that a question for the developer?
It's a question for the developer, yeah.
Okay, well, so...
My basic question is, if you were to conceive of a validation study, what would it look like?
The outcomes that have been shown to be affected by adequacy of dialysis, since we're talking about the pediatric KT over V, going back to the original study looking from which you read Kinetics arose in adults have been hospitalization, and particularly hospitalization for uremic symptoms and mortality, right? And so most of the observational studies link to those two primary outcomes. A person's transplantability could, in theory, be affected or influenced by inadequate dialysis because of general health deterioration, poor nutrition, and whatnot. But that would be less direct, I believe, than what has been shown in the literature, predominantly for adults, as Rajiv has pointed out, which is hospitalization and survival, or hospitalization and mortality.
Okay, so you could use hospitalization as an endpoint for a validation study, even if you don't think the results would be significant. But
yeah, exactly.
Okay.
All right, are we ready to vote on 1423?
Does NQF have any sort of general comment on this issue? So we expect empirical validity testing for maintenance measures. This is a maintenance measure. It's actually been in the field, you know, for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
The developers provided some reasonable rationales for why doing validity study would be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, small number of cases and you know, so what? So we could say in this case, we could say we accept that rationale and sort of pass it on validity based on, I guess, reverting back to the face validity, which is almost a decade old.
Yeah. So that, we do allow
so I guess
that. Exception. Again, if we expect, we do have a sort of general expectation of empiric validity testing on maintenance review. If they are allowed to present face validity, if they can provide a rationale that is acceptable to the group that is reviewing it. So that's sort of your judgment call to make at this point, whether they've given you sufficient or convincing rationale or not.
Yeah. All right. But there's, assuming it sort of passes at this stage, and it is successful with the steering committee, it's 3 years between now and the next maintenance review, and I guess part of the feedback would be to try really hard to think of, a way to sort of assess the validity of this measure.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly feedback we can provide to the developer, and they're hearing it right now as well. All right. Well,
and this is Karen Jeff. Sorry, Andrew. I was just thinking about this. I think, sometimes, whether or not you accept the justifications of, no empirical testing for maintenance measures, sometimes, that might be just a purely kind of data-driven question, but other times it might be a little bit more along the lines of some clinical realities. And in that case, I think that the methods panel, would err on the side of accepting and, allowing the standing committee to make that final determination.
Okay, that makes sense.
This is John Butt. My understanding is the standing committee makes the final determination anyways. But our role is just advisory, right?
Yes. Well, it's advisory, but knowing that you're very steeped in the methods. So, yes, they could certainly vote differently than how you guys do. So, yes, you are correct.
And if you were to hypothetically not move this measure forward, it would not go to the standing committee, so they wouldn't get to make that decision. So you are kind of a gatekeeper, and there is some decision-making on your part in terms of the measure will move forward to the standing committee. But they will obviously make the ultimate endorsement decision.
right. Well, unless there's any additional discussion or any objections to doing so, we can move on to a vote on number 1423. For this one, we will be voting on both reliability and validity. So go ahead to your SurveyMonkey link and give us a rating for reliability and validity for number 1423. And maybe we do have, so we've got a couple more measures. Maybe we could actually skip over 1454 for right now and go to number 2706, just because this is a pediatric peritoneal dialysis adequacy achievement of target KTV, and I think this is very similar to the issues that were raised on the last measure, so maybe we can kind of to see if we have any additional discussion or if we can similarly just take a vote on reliability and validity for this measure as well.
And sorry, what was the number?
2706. And for this one, we actually reached a low insufficient rating for reliability. But just because the issues raised, again, were very essentially the same as the other ones that we had a consensus not reached decision on, we thought it would be reasonable to go ahead and re-vote on this one as well, just to make sure we were consistent across. Just to, again, sort of reiterate here, we had a inter-unit reliability
right,
method of assessing with the bootstrap approach. So just the same kind of issues we've just been discussing. Then, again, we have face validity provided with, I assume, the same rationale, given that this is also a pediatric measure, and just taking a look here, yeah, that's pretty much the same issues we just discussed. So, any additional comments or discussion on measure 2706, or are we okay going ahead and voting on this one?
Can maybe the developer maybe just speak to the denominator exclusions. My recollection was that in the testing document there was a statement that there weren't any exclusions. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Andrew. There was a statement that there were no exclusions, but they mentioned in that statement a number of exclusions that are implicit in the denominator. Basically, the way you're defining your denominator population sort of implies, exclusion of some other patients. I don't know that we wouldn't consider that, sort of the typical kinds of exclusions. It's really just a matter of defining the denominator population, if that makes sense.
That would make sense if the exclusions were all sort of clinical. Like you have to have ESRD in order to be the denominator, right? There's some of them are not really like that. It's like patients who haven't been assigned for a month, patients. So it's fine. But it's just that kind of exclusion isn't really, inherent in the denominator definition.
If I may, this is Joe Masana, and I agree fully. It is confusing, and We apologize. I think when this was written up originally, the intent was to try to be as explicit as possible, and sometimes when you do that, you create more confusion. The denominator definitions excluded adults, excluded patients who hadn't been under the care of a facility for a minimum period of time, et cetera. So they're not really clinical exclusions as the way the term is used, and it's unfortunate that we wrote it up that way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any additional points of discussion on this measure, other concerns or points of clarification, anything like that?
No, my concerns were all things that have been discussed in mm-hmm. previous.
Okay. If there's no objection, we'll go ahead and take a revote on reliability and validity for number 2706. And then I think we can go back and jump up back up to measure number 1454, the proportion of patients with hypercalcemia. We had a low insufficient rating, preliminary rating, for reliability, but again, had the same kinds of concerns we had about the other measures that were consensus not reached, so thought it would be, you know, reasonable to discuss and re-vote on this one again, just for the sake of consistency. I should also note that the developer did actually include some additional reliability analysis for this particular measure by doing some facility-level Pearson correlation coefficients between the current performance month and the preceding month. And got a fairly strong result on that as well. So, just wanted to see if there were any additional comments on reliability for this measure.
I had questions about I'm trying to remember the measure now. Questions on the specifications.
Okay.
There were a bunch of questions that I had here. I'm just sort of, I'm not sure I can summarize them. Maybe we'll just go through them one by one. It wasn't clear to me if there was any standard regarding how frequently the calcium levels need to be drawn.
So this is Joe Masana. Implicit in the measure definition, since it's basically reporting of patient quarter, so 3 month periods of time, and the measure specifies that you take the average of the monthly reported calcium values in that quarter for any given reporting month. So then it rolls to the next month. So you to be flagged as a zero in the numerator, for missing this, you have to not report a calcium value for 3 months, three consecutive months, basically. Not basically, three consecutive months. So if you have less than three values in that reporting quarter, you take the average of whatever values you have, one or two, obviously two values, or you take the one reported value. So the minimum requirement is a calcium every 3 months, which again, falls within the generally accepted standards of care in the dialysis community and comports with the two TEPs that reviewed this as being kind of reasonable and appropriate.
So, going back to our previous discussion, obviously CMS is going to know when you drew calcium levels, but is there anything to prevent somebody from gaming the system? In other words, let's say you have, in the three-month period, you have three calcium levels, and only one of them is really falls within the acceptable range. So, and you report that one, is there a way that this metric will know that you're not reporting two which have been done?
No.
I'm just concerned about gaming the system, that's all.
I appreciate that. I guess the I understand where you're coming at from that point of view. I believe that that's why the original TEP, I was in the room when the TEP developed this, and then subsequently when a 2013 TEP endorsed keeping it as is. That's why they relied on 3 months. It's a pretty low bar, actually. So if someone has three calcium values in the month, two of them are elevated, one of them is normal, the TEP would say, well, you know, we're not clear that there's a safety signal here. It's persistent elevated calcium is what they were driving at. Hmm. And so if it's if you have that much variability or lack of consistency in the hypercalcemia definition, they would say the measure, I believe they would say the measure is behaving as designed. But I understand your concerns. I would be at least glad that the dialysis facility was paying that much attention to the patient's serum calcium to measure it repeatedly in a month.
Interesting. And this is like really very technical, but is there any criteria that say to state that the center has to use a CLIA certified lab? I guess it does in order to report to CMS. Is that?
Yeah. So for Medicare patients and dialysis facilities fall under CLIA certification, having been cited in my own facility for a glucose monitor that wasn't meeting testing. So most dialysis facilities now send their labs out to CLIA-certified labs that are owned within a corporation. But you know, same requirements as for any treatment of any other Medicare patient.
Got it.
All right. Any additional thoughts or comments on measure number 1454?
This is Jeff. Just a question about the sort of analysis on statistically meaningful differences in performance. It's helpful that they sort of did a test and then they sort of repeated the test with more recent data. So in the earlier results, I guess there are about 14.9% of facilities that had a performance worse than expected. And then in the most recent submission, that's gone down to 7.3% of facilities. What's the end game here? You know, like, at what point, you know, are we trying to get to zero? What's the goal?
I'm not sure as a measure developer that I can answer that certainly on CMS's for CMS. But personally, we know that a sizable minority of facilities have zero patients with hypercalcemia. And so if we believe that persistent hypercalcemia is a problem, zero might not be an unreasonable goal ultimately as a clinician who's trying to do, you know, as many of you are trying to do the best that you can. Whether the measure whether the incentives that have been provided by having this measure in the portfolio have resulted in the maximum amount of improvement or not, I don't know. I think you're asking, are we getting to a threshold where you can't expect much better? I don't know what the answer is to that question. I expect that it'll be something that the standing committee would take up if this measure makes it through the methods group.
Yeah. And it's not a burdensome measure. It's based on claims, right? So
it's based on Crown Web data collection, which is part, about 75 or 80% of that is batch submitted by the labs associated with the large dialysis organizations.
Right. It's part of the kind of the monthly or at minimum quarterly panel of labs that are all submitted to Crown Web.
Right. Is it in theory possible to target the data collection more specifically? You know, is it so it's, you know, 500 facilities that have poor performance, is it the same 500 facilities year after year?
There is some overlap. I think it would depend upon your threshold, and the values have been changing. The values have been declining significantly since the measure was implemented. So that answer would probably change. We've only gotten 2015, I believe, was the first year it was publicly reported. So we've got a small number relatively small sample, and the values have been declining over each of the years.
Thank you.
Could people please mute their phone? We're hearing some sort of ringing in the background. Might be us. All right, let's try to continue to hold that. Thank you.
Well, do we have any additional discussion about the reliability of this measure, 1454?
For reliability? No.
Excuse me? All right, we're trying to get this fixed. We're calling the conference company. Well, if we don't have any more discussion on reliability, we can go ahead and vote on number 1454 for reliability.
I had a question on risk adjustment in this particular.
Yeah, you could bring that up. I should note that this one did pass with a high moderate rating, so we won't be revoting on validity unless you request that we do. But go ahead if you want to.
Well, no, I'm just curious. It's is there, might there be, the reason why it's sort of a theoretical thing, I don't know a lot about the physiology here, but I was just curious as to whether or not there might be any evidence that would suggest that the correlation between mortality and elevated calcium was stronger in men versus women and blacks versus whites. It's, you know, in other words, the assumption is that the relationship is the same. I'm just not sure that that's the case. It might be.
This is Joe Masana. We do not have specific evidence that addresses that. The associations were done at the facility level, and the mortality metric that's used is highly risk-adjusted, the standardized mortality ratio, which takes into consideration individual unmeasured facility characteristics by stratification, cause of ESRD, complicated age, splines, race, et cetera. And so it would be difficult to tease it out based on this on the facility level. So I can't answer that question.
Okay. Voting on reliability here?
Yes, we'll be voting on reliability. Unless there's any additional comments to be made, we can vote on reliability for number 1454. And that will, I think, finish us for the set of penal measures, and I'll turn it over to Michael Abrams for one additional measure that we're going to talk a little bit about here.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. So this is Michael Abrams here at NQF. So we're going to power through the ring here, try to stay focused, shifting from kidney to brain and lung here with one measure that we actually had put on a do not discuss list, but then we decided to bring it up for your attention in this call. And that measure is 3492, emergency department use due to opioid overdose. It's at the end for those of you on the subcommittee. It's at the very last measure on your form. On page 23, if you have the PDF in front of you. So, again, it's measure 3492, emergency department use due to opioid overdose. What I'm going to do is give you an overview of that measure. It's been a while since you've seen it. And then focus you on some specific questions, and I will also notify you about why we have held it for the end here. Before I begin, can I ask...
Can I make a recommendation maybe that we can hang up and redo the call?
Can we do that?
If others are willing to do that, that might be the only fix at this point.
Hi there. We actually have an operator who's attempting to take care of this. Is there any way you guys can give 2 minutes?
Sure, let's just give it 2 more minutes.
Operator did it. Good.
Mental stroke.
And this is
very
the
good.
Operator. Yes, I think I muted that line. I didn't want to interrupt the call. I'm going to unmute some of the lines that I muted here so that you'll be able to resume your conference call.
Thank you.
Can
you stick around for a bit and make sure it doesn't happen again?
All you have to do is star 0, and an operator will join and mute that. But I think I muted the line right now.
Thank
you should be okay.
Thank
I will now leave the conference. You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, good. So, again, Michael Abrams here at NQF. So we're discussing now the final measure from this for this subgroup on page 23 of your PDF. It's 3492, emergency department use due to opioid overdose. And I think we have we might have some of the developers on the line from Yale. Is anybody on there? Can you just identify yourself briefly?
This is Alana Richman. I'm from CORE at Yale.
Okay, great. Thank you, Alana, for being on the call. And we're going to go through this measure. I will describe why we held it for the end as I go through it, but it's been a while since you've heard about it, as I said, so I want to give you a little bit of an overview and then focus you on the questions that remain from your review. It was consensus not reached on both reliability and validity, and I'll discuss that in turn. So this is a new measure. Description is it's a claims-based measure that captures the rate of emergency department visits for opioid overdose events using diagnostic codes, ICD diagnostic codes. Events are measured per 1,000 person years among Medicare beneficiaries over the age of 18, residing in geographic areas of interest, which are the unit of analysis, either state or county. It's an outcomes measure, as I said, claims-based. Medicare fee-for-service data was the source principally for the testing that was done from the years 2009 to 2012. And they also used for validity purposes the National Emergency Department sample in order to look for overdose events in that external source. As I said, we're talking about community-level analysis, regional, state, and county principally. State across 5 different states, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and then county-level data in Maryland. Before I describe the results from reliability and validity, let me just skip down to some information about what they demonstrated in terms of meaningful differences. Meaningful differences analysis, Maryland does look above average compared to the 5 other states that they had, and here's a number for you to think about in terms of that. If I've interpreted the results properly, 2.16 overdose events per 10,000 person years covered is the Maryland rate. That's on page 15 of the testing form if you want to look for that. In New Jersey and Pennsylvania, as example comparators, it was about 1.5, so a 25% less rate. Similar issues or variability was observed when they looked at say, Baltimore City, which had 5.3 per 10,000 person years versus, say, Carroll County, a more rural area of Maryland, 0.36, so they demonstrated meaningful differences there. There were no exclusions reported. The other thing I should point out before we discuss reliability and validity is that they didn't do risk adjustment for the measure per se because, or when the measure was implemented and tested, because empirical testing and secondary source citations, even though they demonstrated social factors were influential, there was enough variability and uncertainty about that they felt and they argued that the measure was applicable irrespective of those, so they didn't actually do any social risk factor adjustments. They instead argue with evidence that this measure should be applied equally across different socio-demographic populations. Now, moving back up in the middle of page 23, the ratings for reliability, you all had not reached consensus. One person rated it high, two moderate, and two low. Let me just give you some details about that. The reliability that they did use the Adams R score across five states and they also reported ranges as well, and found that on the state level, the Adams R was 0.86 or higher across the various years and states. So they were comfortable with those results, suggesting good ability for the measure to discriminate between the state level of analysis. With regard to the county level in Maryland, there are 25 jurisdictions that we're talking about. The Adams R always exceeded 0.7. I will point out, however, that it dipped as low, at least in the early years, as low as to 0.41. So it wasn't quite as strong for the county-level data, but the developers still argue that these were reasonable levels, and, of course, even in the county, they exceeded sufficient levels of on an average of 0.71 being the average reliability there. So let me pause there and see if anybody on the committee has any questions or comments about the reliability presentation of this measure.
I had a question about the specification. The numerator is based on events, but it's very unclear. Suppose one person has multiple events. Are they talking about events the events per population is not able to distinguish between multiple events for a few individuals and multiple events spread out over many individuals.
Yes, good question. Could the developer clarify that for us, please?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, the measure does not distinguish between multiple events in a single individual or single events in multiple individuals. And we actually felt like that was appropriate because an overdose event is an overdose event, whether it happens to the same person multiple times or to multiple people. We'd want to capture that name anyway, because each overdose event is an undesirable outcome and associated with downstream risk of morbidity, mortality, cost, et cetera. So, and each overdose event is in some ways an opportunity to intervene. So we felt like it was reasonable and appropriate to capture multiple events.
Very good. Any other comments or questions from the committee about reliability?
This is John Bott. While we're on specifications, I thought the denominator definition was confusing. In the MIF form, it first talks about basically all Medicare fee-for-service cases in the denominator, but then it goes on to start to define an emergency department visit. So it's not clear if the denominator is, a count of everybody in a state who's Medicare fee-for-service or Medicare fee-for-service cases that resulted in ED visits. Then on the numerator side, the Excel file that was attached, there's really some disconnect going on. There's a table specifically, the tab ICD-9 to ICD-10 crosswalk codes. Seems like it's attempting to define numerator events for opiate overdose. But some of those codes clearly are not an opiate overdose. One is R09.2 is a respiratory arrest. So I think there's a lack of some description going on. I think you have to have an opiate overdose code, and it could be supported by a code like that, but it doesn't really clearly defined the numerator in that Excel file. So those were a couple of concerns with the both numerator and denominator.
Yeah, good points. This is Michael here at NQF. So let's break it down. The second point, I think, let's hold for validity. But regarding the first point, could the developer offer us some clarity there?
Yes, absolutely. So the denominator is person time of eligible Medicare beneficiaries, which is essentially everybody with Part A aged 18 and over. The numerator includes all overdose events that result in an emergency department visit. So in claims data, there's not a sort of simple or straightforward way of capturing all emergency department visits, because how emergency department visits are billed depends in part on whether the person was discharged from the emergency department or admitted. And then even within that, there is some complexity around the kind of care they received in the emergency department. For example, it can be billed as critical care or emergency services and so on. So actually, some folks at CORE had developed an algorithm for identifying emergency department visits using claims data, and there are other algorithms out there. But essentially, we first, in the numerator, identify visits in the emergency department from inpatient and outpatient claims. And then from among those visits, we identify those that are associated with a diagnostic code indicative of opioid overdose.
So this is Michael at NQF. Let me just clarify a point, if I may, that
yeah.
came up. So it's plausible somebody could overdose and the substance is unclear,
yeah.
or that they could overdose on something besides an opioid, and they might have a history of opioid addiction and or abuse in another code. Are those potential threats to validity in terms of identifying a specific opioid admission?
Yeah, so this is a central challenge in measuring opioid overdose using claims. So we could either opt for a very specific but potentially insensitive definition or a much broader definition that may be more sensitive but less specific. And there's been actually some work in the published literature around which combination of codes offers the best sensitivity versus specificity. As you might imagine, so there's a core set of ICD-9 codes that indicate things like poisoning from heroin, poisoning from methadone. Those
yeah.
codes are very specific to opioid overdose and are almost never used for events that on, you know, chart review do not appear to be opioid overdose. But, as you point out, there are lots of cases where people come in with other conditions, are unconscious, and the reason for their condition is not immediately apparent, or it could be due to multiple substances or a combination of events. So in consultation with CMMI, for whom we're developing this measure, we opted for a measure that we think balances sensitivity and specificity. So this gets to the second part of that previous question. How is the measure outcome defined? There are two ways that the outcome can be defined. One is if an emergency department visit is associated with one of those very specific codes, poisoning from methadone, poisoning from heroin. The second is a broader set of codes that are probably more sensitive but potentially less specific. So in that second definition, we include cases where a patient might come in with, for example, respiratory depression plus a history of opioid use disorder. I will say that those codes contributed only sort of minimally to the number of cases that we identified, so most of the cases in the measure are from the more specific definition.
So let me stop you there. So
yeah.
is there in your application, did you quantify for us? I don't remember if you quantified for us
how much of a threat
to specificity there is. Just a yes or no would be fine, and then we can look for it. If it's there, and if it's not there, we know it's not.
We didn't, although we referenced some of the literature that answered that question.
Very good. John, I think you posed that question. Does that address both of your questions about numerator, denominator, specifications?
I'd have to read it now in a different way and think about it, but just in general, it's not it's not a very clearly defined numerator and denominator, and having read hundreds and hundreds of technical specifications, which I think leads to the risk of different people picking this up and unevenly applying the measure specification, and that's the spirit of why measure specifications is in the reliability section.
This is very good.
Jim, I have a question.
Go ahead, please.
In the denominator statement, it says the denominator is the population at risk for opioid overdose, and then the definition of the denominator is basically everybody. So is that true? So some of the variation across counties could be attributable to the health systems in those counties, but some of it could be attributable to variation in people that are actually at risk. So the question is, did you actually consider a more refined denominator of people that are that have a non-zero probability of an opioid overdose?
Yeah, I mean, right, on some level it's a deep philosophical question, who's actually at risk for opioid overdose. We did consider a more narrow definition, or excluding certain populations at least, and again, in consultation with CMMI, we opted for the broadest possible definition.
Okay.
We had a sort of a minor technical question. This was all based on ICD-9 data. Did we have any evidence that conversion to ICD-10 would result in a true in the same outcomes?
Yes,
same, you know, sensitivity, validity, et cetera. Sensitivity, specificity.
Paul, thank you for bringing that up. That's actually the reason that staff pulled the measure, because they did not do testing in ICD-10. And so we're still trying to decide in our maintenance whether or not we're going to carry this measure forward, but we appreciate you considering that. And since you brought up that question, then could the developer briefly tell us why they didn't do ICD-10 testing at this point, even though they have specifications for ICD-10 identification of these of this measure?
Can I add on to that? So In the testing form, there's a comment that you didn't anticipate the reliability and validity to change over time, but then in the actual results, there's a very clear trend in reliability, so that seems contradictory. So if you could address that too.
Sure. So beginning with ICD-9, we chose to develop the measure in ICD-9 because for really two reasons. One is that there's been some other work by other organizations developing ways to measure opioid overdose using ICD-9 codes, and probably the most work has been done in ICD-9, so that's where we started. And secondly, we wanted to look at trends over time, in part because we know that overdose rates are increasing over time, and so we wanted to sort of make sure that those general trends that we know exist from, you know, every time we read the newspaper, that those are reflected in our data, and we certainly saw that in the state of Maryland. It's true that reliability has increased over time. That, I think, again, reflects the fact that overdose rates are increasing over time, which contributes to improved reliability. So sorry for that contradictory statement, but you're correct.
How far back can you go now, Michael, at NQF, and get ICD-10 now?
So,
at least in 2016, and it's good, right?
Right. So looking ahead, we used, as you mentioned, the National Emergency Department sample and a separate measure or definition of opioid overdose developed by ARC in a distinct population for validation. And that data does exist publicly for 2016. So one approach to validating in ICD-10 would be to use that 2016 data from ARC.
Okay. All right. Any other? Thank you for that. Any other questions about reliability here now before we take a revote on that, if you'd like to do that? Any other questions about reliability?
So this is Karen from NQF. I do just want to point out, and Michael alluded to this, but I think I want to make it a little bit more clear. We had originally pulled this measure, and we were actually going to not discuss it and ask the developer to bring it back next cycle because they did not do testing with ICD-10 data. We have had for the past year and a half, roughly, maybe a little bit more, we have indicated that as of 2019, we would want to see testing of ICD-10-based measures with ICD-10-based data. So I think as you think about this measure and revoting, you know, think about, you know, this requirement that we have had in terms of testing and whether or not you would feel comfortable kind of replacing what the testing from the ICD-9 rather than the 10. Hopefully that makes sense.
And just to jump in for one moment, if it were possible, we would be happy to submit data from 2016 using that approach that I alluded to with ARC data for the next consideration. I mean, for if this measure were to move ahead.
Yeah. So we have two cycles for a purpose. So we want to just stick to that. We do have many measures besides yours. So just want to clarify that. But we understand that this is we'll make internally at NQF. So for the committee, the issue is just reliability. Questions about reliability specifically.
So the reliability testing does not depend on the ARC data. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So you could do 2016 ICD-10 reliability testing without using ARC. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't use the availability of the ARC data to dictate the currency of your reliability testing.
Any other comments about reliability or questions about that? Okay, hearing none, so why don't you take let's do a revote on reliability for this measure. I'll remind you of the measure number, 3492, emergency department use due to opioid overdose.
We're only voting on reliability?
Yep, and then we'll talk about validity. Moment and vote on that separately. But I'm going to go ahead. So, yes, please do vote on reliability for 3492. And while you're casting your ballot there, I'm going to move on to validity and just remind you about that and see if there are any comments or questions. We've already have started to talk about that in terms of the numerator definition. So one issue was, you know, specificity of overdoses, so we talked about that, but let me just remind you what kind of validity testing that they did. They used the NEDS, this national sample of emergency department events, and compared it against their Medicare claims in order to see if they got similar numbers. And really what they were doing in my review seemed to be was numerator comparisons. These were data between 2009 and 2012, just to remind you. And numerator events in a given year were something on the order of 817 for a given year. In 817 in 2009, and they increased to 1,632 in 2012. That's based on the measure. You can compare that to the NEDS data. It was pretty close, 850 and 1,750 events respectively. So very close correspondence between the NEDS and the Medicare claims, and suggesting that there was an external source or kind of gold standard with regard to the overdoses that they were detecting. They reported a correlation coefficient. No P was reported, but presumably with those large numbers was significant P. Again, this was ICD-9 data testing that was done. No county level breaks for that kind of look was done, no exclusions reported, and as I said, they didn't do any risk adjustments. So, but they justified why they didn't. Any comments then or additional points of clarification regarding validity testing on this measure from anybody on the panel?
Well, I sort of, the fact that, I mean, NEDS, as I understand it, is sort of an all-payer database, whereas Medicare is the Medicare population.
They did narrow their poll to Medicare. Am I correct? Can the developer clarify that?
Yes, we actually compared rates in NEDS and rates in our population and absolute events in the Medicare component of NEDS and in our population. And in both cases, we got pretty similar results.
Okay.
The definition used by ARC is slightly different. I think that's what we felt was reassuring. Even with a kind of different formulation of opioid overdose, we kind of approximate the same population. We get very close to the same numbers.
Okay, so NEDS does permit you to subspecify the Medicare population.
Yes.
Okay. No, I was just wondering because the opioid problem is a little more concentrated in younger patients, so I wouldn't necessarily expect a correlation between NEDS and Medicare. But
yeah, good question. Go ahead.
So I'm not sure exactly what's being tested here, so I'm not sure I understand why NEDS would be considered any kind of a gold standard. They're both based on administrative data, basically same claims data. Just one set of claims data goes to Medicare and another set of claims data goes to the state that then sends the data to ARC. So I don't see them as being different. I mean, the algorithm, so is the claim that somehow the algorithm that ARC uses is considered a gold standard and you're somehow validating your algorithm for identifying these, and if that's the case, why don't, I mean, it seems like the validity issue here is, are these ED visits for opioid
yeah.
are not, yeah. So, like a chart review or something.
I had the same problem. It's exactly
yeah.
the same problem.
Yeah, the developer, please, would you comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
So that's a fair point. So I'll say two things. One is that there was a study by some folks at UCSF, Christopher Rowe and Phil Coffin, that looked at various combinations of codes using a chart review. And essentially the kind of core codes that comprise this measure have very high specificity. That's number one. Two, it's a fair point. You're comparing one claims-based measure against another, but it's one that was externally validated. We have sort of nothing to do with how the data are collected, how emergency department visits are identified, and so on. And so, you know, at all points along our measure development, we had to make decisions about each of those things, and we still sort of arrive at a similar conclusions or similar results with the measure. But fundamentally, is the ARC measure getting at opioid overdose? It is in many ways still a claims-based measure, but one, you know, that was at least developed independently from ours.
Yeah, I mean that's something, right? Like you said, I mean, there's two groups follow an independent process and come to a similar conclusion. That's some validation that your process was valid. Another thing, you know, that you might have done is to say, so there's no real explicit kind of quality idea here. It's like, why are you, other than just the fact that, you know, some counties might have higher risk populations than others, and you've kind of discounted that by just including everybody in the denominator. You know, there's no statement about why you would expect one area. And if this is for CMMI, I guess it'd be like one, I don't know, whatever, ACO or whatever, whatever entity. So that's one question. Like, you define this at a county level. I assume it's going to be applied at some sort of group level. And that, you know, whether anything that you've done at the county level justifies any kind of an inference about application to like a medical group or something is like a totally different question, but there's not really any sort of statement here about why you'd expect variation in these population rates to be different. And if you had sort of an hypothesis, you could test it to say, you know, characteristics of County A, characteristics of County B that are related to the sufficiency of the healthcare system or whatever it is that you're trying to get at with this measure, and then show that those differences in quality actually impact the result. That's kind of what we would expect, I think, from a validity test, you know, of a metric.
Yeah, it's complicated because, I mean, there's a whole kind of econometrics literature dedicated to which policies improve at the population level opioid overdose. And as you can imagine, it's a really hard question because there's a lot of endogeneity, like the populations that are at highest risk have the highest opioid overdose. So it's a challenging sort of question to tease out. But what we do know is that there are lots of things from the health system standpoint that can be done to reduce overdose, you know, foremost of which include providing medication-assisted treatment, to some extent reducing the availability of opioids, and then treating opioid overdose, which is a separate question that's not actually really covered by this measure, like how to reduce mortality from overdose.
Right.
But it's actually a very complicated question, like how to prove that policy ideas improve opioid overdose. But what we do think is important is to be able to measure it, to identify the areas, the communities that are at greatest need, and to track trends over time, which is the, you know, sort of the goal of developing this measure.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This sort of goes to the rationale for the measure, which was left blank, and it sort of left me a little bit confused.
Right.
Because if what you're suggesting, in other words, if this metric is meant to be applied in order to identify a problem, that's one thing. If this metric is meant to be used as a quality metric for the care in a community, then that's a completely different thing. Because in the first case, you wouldn't necessarily want to risk adjust because you're just identifying the problem, and then you can know where to look and try to understand it. On the other hand, if you're using it as a quality metric, then you have a huge problem not risk adjusting, because if one county or one subpopulation, whatever population group you're looking at, has individuals who are at higher risk, then they're going to look worse, even though the quality of their services may actually be much more sophisticated and better than another county where the problem doesn't even exist.
All right. This is Michael here at NQF. This is good discourse and certainly related to the validity of the connection between the measure and quality. So the developer should take note that when and if you bring this to the standing committee in your evidence presentation, you make it clear what that link is, of course. We're almost at time here, so I want to be efficient wrapping this up. Any other specific questions about validity testing on this particular measure here, such as it's presented, at this point? Any other questions or comments before we go to a revote on that?
So this is Bijan. So I have, again, it's more like clarifying questions. So as I understand, you use data from NATS from 2009 to 2012, and then you do talk about this bridge between the ICD-9 and ICD-10. I guess, I mean, why are you even talking about it in that testing form? Because I think that is data, like, you know, until 2012 would be pre-ICD-10 data, right, in NEDS?
Yes, all of the 2009-12 is ICD-9 data.
Yeah, there is a statement in that your testing document. It says that, I mean, again, maybe that was probably a typo or whatever. So, that was, for me, it was confusing. I mean, I was trying to understand as to why you are even talking about it, because that, and if you are using some data through 2012, that would not have any ICD-10 diagnosis to begin with.
It may have just been a broader statement about the measure specifications, but yes, all of the testing was done in ICD-9.
Okay.
Any other questions about validity before we take a vote here and close out the call? All right, good. Hearing no objections then, let's have you do a revote on measure number 3492. And this is on validity, measure 3492 on validity. And while you're doing that, I want to thank you very much for your attention, and to the developers as well who joined at the very last minute for us. And I'll hand it back to Poonam to close out the call.
Okay. So this is the end of the call. We're done with all of the subgroup ones. Once you get your voting results in, we'll know what measures are moving forward. So thank you, everyone, for your time, and we'll let you know the full results from your evaluations as soon as we can. Any questions before we let you go?
Not for me. This will be done. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much for all your hard work. Really appreciate it.
Yes.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you all. Bye.
Thank you. Please stand by.